So our second presentation this morning will be co-presented by Sandra Pullman and Justin Diebler, both Assistant Attorneys General in the Civil Rights Bureau of the New York State Attorney General's Office. Sandra prosecutes violations of city, state, and federal anti-discrimination law with a particular focus on gender identity, criminal history, reproductive rights, and the school-to-prison pipeline. Sandra is also an adjunct clinical professor at Brooklyn Law School, where she teaches a civil rights clinic. Prior to joining the OAG, she represented employees in individual and class action lawsuits and counseled clients about their rights in the workplace. Sandra is a 2008 graduate of Harvard Law School, and after graduation, she clerked for the Honorable Susan Mollway, Chief Judge in the U.S. District Court for the District of Hawaii. The following year, she served as a Georgetown Women's Law and Public Policy Fellow, where she drafted amicus briefs urging an expansive interpretation of anti-discrimination law and coordinated advocacy on behalf of pregnant workers. Justin Diebler is a recipient of the Louis J. Lefkowitz Memorial Award for outstanding performance on behalf of the people of the state of New York. In recognition of his work on the office's report on arrests arising from the New York City Police Department's stop and frisk practices. His docket covers a variety of areas, including employment, public accommodations, and education. He has conducted LGBT enforcement and advocacy work in connection with major corporations, the Boy Scouts of America, and professional sports leagues. He received his BA summa cum laude from Swarthmore College and his JD magna cum laude from the Harvard Law School. Ms. Pullman and Mr. Diebler will address the best practices for serving the transgender patients.
Hi, I'm Justin.
And
we want to thank Milmic for having us here today. Over the past, 2 years, we've done public education outreach work partnering with hospital associations around New York State. And I think it was in April at an event with the Iroquois Healthcare Association in Utica that a representative from Milmic approached us who was there and asked us to come today. So we're very grateful to be here. We're kind of mindful, especially hearing the presentation before, of the ways in which insurers and risk managers are also stakeholders in ensuring legal compliance for health providers. So it's in that spirit that that we hope that this information will be helpful to all of you today.
So a little background on us. At the AG's office, we are in the Civil Rights Bureau. The office, in particular our bureau, enforces federal, state, local civil rights law. Got a list of the protected categories, which are many, and I'm sure you're all familiar with. So in addition, we conduct outreach, we do public education work. It's fun for us to be in a situation where we're not suing someone. It's also fun to sue people, as you can imagine. And I think as lawyers, that's our go-to when we sense that there's a lack of compliance, to put it nicely. We want to file a lawsuit, and that's not always the best approach, especially when you're working with hospitals. You're working with, I work with a lot of school districts. Certainly we're not seeking tremendous damages. We just want to see that anti-discrimination law is complied with. And so to that end, we're here, and we hope that this is informational, that it helps people develop best practices, helps them avoid liability, which I know is the main goal here. And we hope that people should feel free to participate, ask questions, do whatever you want. No question, no matter how damning it may seem, is going to get you a subpoena from our office, we promise. But the reason we're here is that I know that we had talked about perhaps doing a larger presentation about LGBT rights in the healthcare setting, but it seems that the real problems come with the transgender community. And there's just been widespread documentation about how much discrimination this group faces. So Lambda Legal has run a survey saying that actually transgender patients tend to be, they experience discrimination at 2 to 3 times more than lesbian, gay, and bisexual patients. 2011 survey found that about a fifth of transgender respondents said they've been refused healthcare outright because of their gender identity. More than a quarter of them had postponed care, and about a third had delayed or not sought care. And obviously we're here as lawyers and you're here to talk about liability, but I think obviously we all have these shared goals because of the human cost. If there is discrimination, whether motivated by animus or just ignorance, people are not getting the care that they need. And hopefully we can use our blunt instrument of anti-discrimination law and your expertise in the field to try to address that. As always, things are worse for transgender individuals who are also low income or who are minorities. That number, about a fifth of trans patients being refused care, turns into 36% if you're American Indian, 22% if you're Hispanic, and 28% if you have public insurance. This comes to us not only from sort of reading literature or looking at numbers on a page. We've actually received a tremendous amount of complaints. And that's how lawsuits get started, at least from our agency. Someone calls in and says, I was discriminated against. Our jurisdiction at the AG's office is not over individual complaints. We're not even a complaint-driven agency where we have to adjudicate everything that comes through our door. Rather, we bring essentially pattern or practice. It's really practice or policy in our language. But the idea is pattern or practice lawsuits that address violations that affect a larger group of people. And so we receive all of these complaints, and typically when we receive a complaint, look into it, start to investigate, see if anyone else was affected. And the complaints we received range from all of these denial of treatment, I was harassed, I was insulted, I was physically abused, my confidentiality and privacy were not respected, I, you know, informed staff that I identify as a woman and they kept referring to me as a man and using male pronouns. They refused to use my preferred name. They insisted on assigning me to a male, you know, male part of the facility. And unfortunately, a common refrain was, I was provided service, but every time I was treated by a physician, there were, you know, 5 to 10 other people in the room who were looking at me like a guinea pig. And, you know, maybe that was well-meaning, but it made me feel awful. And the reason that we started doing this work instead of just filing one lawsuit and hoping that other institutions took notice is that the complaints actually came from a variety of institutions. There were more than one at some places, but for the most part, they were across the state. They were across different hospitals and providers, and it let us know that this seems to be an industry-wide problem, and I think the statistics they cited earlier really confirm that. Justin mentioned we worked with this group Iroquois. We partnered with them most recently to talk to that hospital association about compliance, and before that the Greater New York Hospital Association, which is downstate. And that's why we're here, is to do this in a public education and outreach way so that hopefully we can kind of move the industry forward and not have to be on the other side of a lawsuit. Let me pass that over.
Great. So so the title of this presentation was Best Practices in Serving Transgender Patients, and so we're going to take the long way there. By that I mean the legal way. And I think that the reason we're going to talk a little bit about law now is that I think that with that context, it'll help inform why these best practices are suggested as ways to avoid liability. So I'm going to turn now to the scope of the anti-discrimination laws as they relate to transgender patients. So who's covered by the law? So both state and New York City law prohibit discrimination in public accommodations on the basis of sex and or gender identity, and there are some sites for those who are interested. Hospitals, nursing homes, outpatient centers, any place that treats or offers medical health-related services are covered by these laws if they're open to the public. So given that these health institutions are covered by the anti-discrimination laws, how do these laws think about transgender folks? So one way in which individuals, trans individuals, are protected is as on the basis of sex. The state human rights law prohibits discrimination on that basis, and it's applied in accordance with federal standards. And federal law prohibits sex discrimination in a way that applies to transgender individuals as well. So a lot of you may know, who aren't lawyers, that the law develops through many ways, through passage of laws in a legislature, through courts rendering decisions that become a kind of law as they interpret the law. And so what you had in this case of the transgender moment, as a lot of people have described it now, is a real evolution rapidly in the law. Some of that has been legislative. A lot of that has been through the courts and through executive regulations, by a recent one by the governor that we're going to see in a moment. So there's a whole lot of ways this has been evolving. So one is sex discrimination. You can't, you know, turn away someone on the basis of sex for health services. Courts have interpreted that to include transgender individuals. Also, certain laws like New York City's and a regulation we'll see in a minute also prohibit discrimination based on gender identity, which is something distinct from sex. So here's an example from the city law. The term gender shall include actual or perceived sex and also include a person's gender identity, self-image, appearance, behavior, or expression, whether or not that identity, image, appearance, behavior, or expression is different from that traditionally associated with the legal sex assigned to that person at birth. So that's sort of a very detailed description of what gender identity can include that's distinct from the biological sex somebody was born with. And that's another protected status under the law. Another basis for this kind of a protection for gender identity is the Affordable Care Act, and I'm sure all of you are familiar with this. Section 1557 of the ACA also prohibits discrimination on the basis of sex in any hospital or health program that receives federal funds. So a little while later, in August 2012, HHS clarified by regulation that this prohibition on sex also includes gender identity, all those kinds of elements of appearance, behavior, self-image that we discussed a moment ago. And there's ways that, you know, folks can file a complaint with the OCR office at HHS if they have a complaint of discrimination. So, and then getting it more formal, in May of this year, HHS actually issued a rule implementing Section 1557 that really, like, crossed the T's and dotted the I's on this point about gender identity being a protected status. So this section of the regulation states that a covered entity under the ACA shall not have or implement a categorical coverage exclusion or limitation for all health services related to gender transition, or deny or limit coverage for specific health services related to gender transition if that denial or limitation results in discrimination against the transgender individual. So that we got very specific in this HHS reg about what would amount to discrimination on the basis of gender identity. And that's very new. That's just a few months ago. Another source of this kind of protection is the Joint Commission. And as of 2011, the commission also requires hospitals accredited under the Hospital and Critical Access Hospital programs prohibit discrimination on the basis of gender identity as well. So you can see how from all these different kinds of sources, federal law, state law, regulations, the Joint Commission, there are certain requirements that now and here for all health providers. And so if they're not familiar with you yet, we're happy to be here talking about them today. So then the law, as I alluded to before, kind of looks at a person in a whole host of different ways. And so a transgender individual can be protected in a number of respects from discrimination the way the law looks at them. Another way is in the form of discrimination against disabled people. So New York state law also prohibits discrimination in public accommodations on the basis of a disability. Gender dysphoria, which is a medical term for a transgender identity, if that, you know, causes a person some form of psychological distress, I think would be the barometer, has been held to be a disability under state law. So as far back as the early 2000s, courts were already saying, if someone has a diagnosis, at that time it was called gender identity disorder, the DSM-5 is now calling this gender dysphoria. If you have that diagnosis, courts way back, you know, more than 10 years ago, began saying you may have a disability that is a protected status under the law. And a state law requires reasonable accommodations for a person with disability so they can access the goods or services, health services that a hospital or clinic is providing. Now, this got even more formal, kind of in a similar way to that HHS reg I was talking about a minute ago. Also, very recently, in November of last year, the New York State Division of Human Rights published a proposed regulation after a call from the governor. In late December, a 45-day comment period ended, and as of January of this year, the regulation has become effective. And we just want to stress here that the Division of Human Rights is a distinct entity. It's not the same agency as our office. I always want to be clear about that. They are another anti-discrimination agency within the state government. What does this regulation do? It sort of, again, codifies what courts were doing for a long time. You know, the courts begin to make law, and then legislatures and the executive branch issue regulations to sort of firm that up. And this is what happened here as well. So this regulation, there's a lot of text here, but in essence, it defined what gender identity means for purposes of state laws. And it's very similar to the description that I shared a moment ago. It defines a transgender person as an individual who has a gender identity different from the sex assigned to him or her at birth. And it also defined gender dysphoria, that medical term I mentioned, as a recognized medical condition related to an individual having a gender identity different from the sex assigned to him or her at birth. What else did this regulation do? It essentially codified what the courts were doing. It said discrimination on the basis of gender identity amounts to sex discrimination under state anti-discrimination law, under the human rights law. It also said that, you know, wherever in the human rights law the term sex is used, consider it the same as gender identity or the status of being transgender. Now, similar to the disability angle we were discussing a minute ago, this regulation also says discrimination based on gender dysphoria is disability discrimination for purposes of our state human rights law. So again, crossing the T's, dotting the I's. So that's kind of the basic framework for how, in our jobs as civil rights lawyers, how we go about looking at, you know, what would amount to discrimination against a transgender person. And you know, what laws in our toolkit would we be using to analyze if a health provider may have violated the law? And so now I'm going to turn it back over to Sandra, who's going to sort of look through some of the cases that have come up to date as to, you know, what those legal requirements I just described, what they place upon health providers.
So there's not going to be a quiz on those different laws, but I think that we go through them both to obviously impress upon all of you where what we're talking about, why we're here. We're not healthcare providers. We have no insight into what you do or anything to offer on that end. But from our perspective, under the law, you know, this is an obligation. This is a requirement. This isn't sort of, you know, these anti-discrimination mandates are not just sort of advisory. You know, they're very stringent, and there's a whole host of them. And as Justin explained, sort of two categories of thinking about what discrimination is when it comes to transgender patients. One is our typical understanding in the way that I can't be discriminated against as a woman. That means I can't be treated any differently than similarly situated men. Transgender patients can't be treated differently, or a fact pattern you see often is harassed because of their gender identity. The disability rights framework does put obligations above and beyond non-discrimination on providers. And it's not just that you have to treat everyone the same, regardless of whether they identify as transgender or not. It's that you may have to make some accommodations. And this arises a lot. Without getting into it, it's suffice to say that there's a decent debate among advocates whether gender dysphoria, you know, the labeling someone as disabled is not always welcomed by people in the community, as you can understand, but you can be transgender and not have gender dysphoria. That aside, given this framework that has been developed in New York about gender dysphoria as a disability that must be accommodated, it does mean that there are instances where the needs of someone with gender dysphoria are not just identical to someone without. They don't just need equal treatment. They might need some special treatment, not anything that poses an undue burden on the provider, but some reasonable accommodations. So this is the slightly fun, I guess this is wonky lawyer fun. My law students love this stuff, talking through some of the cases that have recently been filed and what fact patterns got people in trouble. So these cases are not in the healthcare context, but Doe v. Bell actually was in the prison context. But liability was established where the institution failed to allow a transgender person to access spaces, clothing, or other items in accordance with her gender identity. In other words, you know, incarcerating the transgender woman, you know, someone who had transitioned from male to female, with men was a violation. You know, not permitting her to wear female clothes, not permitting her to use female restrooms and female specific areas. That comes up, as you'll see, in our policy recommendations. Also, you know, as mentioned, you see a lot of these discrimination cases around gender identity, unfortunately, having to do with harassment. There's some really nasty fact patterns. And again, not in the healthcare context, but establishing liability for harassment in public accommodations. The Toys R Us case actually had to do with not the employees of Toys R Us, but the customers, and the employer failed to protect the transgender employees from actually the customers who were incredibly hostile, verbally abusive to their employees based on their gender identity. And so, and unfortunately, New York City subways, this case had to do with an employee who was, or multiple employees, who were using discriminatory, harassment, and transphobic language against riders of the subway. So the public accommodations case law obviously applies to healthcare providers. Specifically, this is one of the sticking points that we're going to discuss in more detail, but when you have sex-segregated facilities, this is usually the area where people come forward and say, I don't know what to do. This person was born male, identifies as female, or vice versa. Where do I put them? It is permissible under the law to segregate people by sex, specifically in restrooms, in patient rooms, et cetera. It's probably an issue that you all face. But the Human Rights Commission has come out and made it clear that if you don't permit someone to use a restroom consistent with their gender identity or be housed in a sex-segregated facility, or you actually prohibit someone, you require identification before they're allowed to use a restroom, you know, if you have any kind of policy that says if you've changed your medical, you know, if you've changed your identification, you can use the girls' bathroom. All of this is really, hopefully understandably, harassing, discriminatory, and not permitted under, at least according to the Human Rights Commission. So a recently filed case, very recently, they're in a discovery now, there's a lot of disputes over less interesting things like who needs to turn over documents. But this case filed in Minnesota is filed in federal court and describes a transgender individual's experience with an emergency room. And the patient just documented all the hostility, the disparaging comments, really aggressive, embarrassing questions about who he was sleeping with, and apparently some very brusque and apparently assaultive, painful exam. And this was a patient who was treated. You know, this isn't someone who was turned away. Obviously, there's a lot more to discrimination than simply saying, I won't serve you because of who you are. So with all that framework in mind, there are a set of best practices for serving transgender patients. I promise you, Justin and I did not come up with them. People with a lot more knowledge than us. Specifically, Lambda Legal and Human Rights Commission, the City Bars LGBT Commission, in consultation with a lot of healthcare professionals, discussed with them what challenges the healthcare community is facing in serving transgender patients and tried to provide clarity. And so while these are best practices, the idea is that if you follow these policies and do your best to abide by them, this is sort of your best way to put mechanisms in place to avoid harassment, avoid discrimination, and ensure that all of your staff is on board with equal and appropriate treatment of transgender patients.
Yeah, and I think that I think that the issues concerning the access of transgender individuals to facilities are, I think you have to be under a rock not to know this is being hotly litigated around the country right now, particularly in North Carolina, where it's become a gigantic liability for the state as a whole. But that issue involved, among other things, restroom access. And so what I hope is that the laws and the sort of case studies that arose from different filed lawsuits assist in kind of giving the context for this. So essentially, if you're open to the public, like health providers are, and someone comes in as a transgender man or transgender woman, they have to be treated as anybody else, or as Sandra said, with sometimes a reasonable accommodation, as the sex they present to you. And so we hope that as we work through these sorts of best practices that were inspired by the sources that Sandra mentioned, we can have a productive dialogue here, because many of these issues are new for many folks and for many institutions. And so we're here to sort of share with you what the law requires. We're here to share with you how we would go about analyzing. If we got a complaint from someone that you insure or someone that you're a risk manager for, we want to sort of provide insight on how we would think through what kind of a claim we might bring to help you develop practices in advance to keep that from happening. So with that as our goal, we're going to trade off the various practices drawn from these sources here that Sandra mentioned. This is the sort of the origin of these model policies, which, again, are not binding legal obligations, but they're a sort of gold standard that we think would help provide appropriate, non-discriminatory, competent care, and help avoid liability in the future. So totally welcome your input. You know, as Sandra mentioned, we are not health providers ourselves. We are taking a deeper and deeper dive in, we're consumers of healthcare, but we are currently taking deeper and deeper dives into a host of issues related to transgender health within our bureau, but we don't stand in your shoes. You guys will always know more about this than we will. So the first policy is a fairly straightforward one. This is a gender identity or expression non-discrimination policy. So we suggest a health institution implement, publish, and update the hospital's non-discrimination policy with words like these: X does not discriminate against any person on the basis of gender identity or gender expression. And that kind of a policy should be communicated to a health institution's own employees as well as their patients. We recommend posting it on the hospital's website, in patient waiting areas, employee work areas. We suggest including it in materials routinely given to patients at admitting or registration or at other times that are appropriate. Include it in materials that are routinely available for takeaway in waiting areas. Basically, publicizing this however you can in an appropriate fashion to the public at large and to the institution's employees, like at orientation.
And I can tell you, when I cut a subpoena for any alleged violation of an anti-discrimination law, one of the first categories on that subpoena is, give me all documents related to your anti-discrimination policy if you have one. Give me all documents related to your training of your staff on this policy, if you have any. The lack of a policy and the lack of training is not evidence of discrimination, and the existence of a policy and training is not obviously a complete defense to an act of discrimination. But you're far more likely to be able to show that you did your best. You may always have some employee with bias. You may have a rogue employee who acts, you know, outside of what they've been trained to do. But that's not a case that Justin and I want to bring in court or sue someone over. I mean, that is a case, and we've had those cases, and sometimes the solution is replace that or train that person and keep on doing what you're doing and maybe, you know, beef up your training. But the setting the tone for a respectful workplace and making clear what the expectations are is pretty key. So we understand that there's a state-required patient's bill of rights, and that's not something that you can tinker with. It is what it is. But one of the best practices is actually just adding a supplement or an amendment to the Bill of Rights, an addition, really, just to say that expressly include gender identity and gender expression as a basis for which someone cannot be discriminated against, and specifically noting that people have the right to considerate, respectful care, free from harassment or abuse, that patients have a right to confidentiality. You have the right to refuse to be examined, observed, or treated by students or staff where the primary purpose is educational and not therapeutic for the patient. And there are, this has been flagged for us in the past about, you know, that there might be some logistical difficulties with where does that go, how do you add, you know, how do you put on a supplement? And I think there's a variety of ways to approach that. Again, something you would know better than us, but making it clear again that you are at an institution that does not tolerate discrimination.
Whatever practical method an institution uses to supplement the Bill of Rights, I just want to underline again, because Sandra had mentioned that we've gotten information accounts of this happening before, specifically the piece saying that a patient has the right not to be examined by, you know, students or interns for training purposes beyond the directly therapeutic primary, you know, caregiver or doctor. This comes up a lot, and it's the kind of thing that, you know, when we hear allegations like that, we want to know immediately, did the institution have a policy, and did the institution disclose to patients, you can say no to this? Because by the time it's happened, it's pretty much too late, and it's a deeply, you know, upsetting. And it happens to a certain group of people over and over again, for sure. But it's something that cuts sort of right to the core of like humanity for a patient. And so the frequency with which we hear this really made me want to underline again of the many things that I think you should be supplementing your patient's Bill of Rights with respect to transgender folks. That's definitely one of them. So the next policy has to do with admitting and registration records. And this, you know, again, here we're mindful there are many, many practical considerations, electronic medical records and this sort of stuff. That we hear time and again when we do these presentations. But let's outline some of the basic kind of concepts here. So what's at stake? You know, intake and admitting, if you think about it, is one of a patient's first encounters with the institution. And the process of self-identification, which is a huge part of a transgender identity in general, presents unique challenges for these patients. So there's a couple of underlying themes that we've touched a bit on already, confidentiality, a spectrum of options provided to patients, and trying to follow the patient's leads. And these themes will come up in the ways to implement this type of best practice. With respect to confidentiality, an intake form should contain language indicating that information provided in it will be treated confidentially in accordance with the law. It should also contain an option to discuss any item on the form privately with a health professional in lieu of answering in writing. And I think this is a very, very, very important piece of this, is providing a transgender patient the option to say, you know what, I don't want to write this down. Can I speak to someone about how to complete this intake form somewhere private? In terms of a spectrum of options, starting with gender, one option is to add in female to male or male to female on the intake forms concerning the gender question. Adding in an option of other, additional, or decline to answer. Add in a question concerning the sex assigned at birth, because some combination of these can provide your institution the information that you need, while also kind of minimizing the burden and stress placed upon a transgender patient to fit within literally the boxes we're all used to checking. Also adding in a question, gender marker listed on medical insurance records, because I know you're all familiar with this, and we hear this a lot too, you know, kind of the downstream when a patient needs certain kinds of procedures, and then you get insurance rejections because someone has a certain gender marker on an insurance record that's different, say, than their legal marker or what they put down at intake, and this can present problems about simply delivering care to transgender patients. So kind of the more the better in a way at the intake process. Adding in these questions because I think in combination they provide the institution what they need. Now in terms of name, including an option for a legal name and a preferred name, including an option for preferred pronoun in the event that the gender questions or preferred name don't fully clarify. And then finally, following the patient's lead, rather than inquiring, guessing, or speculating, staff can provide forms, allow the patient to disclose gender identification, and then follow the patient's lead in this regard. And again, this dovetails with the idea of giving patients the option to have a kind of private consultation with an intake official if there's a, you know, trouble simply writing out the form.
It so one of the reasons we do this outreach, and again, instead of just filing lawsuits, is that I think that this is something that may not occur to those of us who don't identify as transgender, and that's why it sort of falls more in the, I would say the legal analysis is more of a disability accommodation. I don't care if I'm asked to identify M or F. I think there's a clear answer, and I can easily do it with no need for privacy or further discussion. But obviously, for someone who has transitioned from male to female, who may have one, you know, may present one way, may have one thing on their medical records, may have something else on their driver's license, it really is tricky. And again, going back to those statistics about people who are either denied care or eventually stopped trying to access health care because of the way they were treated, that treatment starts at intake. So moving forward, starting with intake and moving forward to the general interaction with transgender patients, it's very straightforward. You know, use the pronouns and names preferred by the patient. You know, the first thing is just if someone shows up in a skirt, assume that they want to be used, want to be addressed as a woman. You know, if someone shows up wearing a tie, it seems clear that they're presenting as a man, use male pronouns. I mean, this isn't a rigid protocol that every person, particularly non-transgender people, and everyone needs to be, you know, have a 10-page survey about how they identify. But, you know, staff should know that they should treat anyone in the, just based on the way that they present. And if they're wrong, you know, a simple apology and course redirection and using the, if they're corrected by the patient, again, use the pronouns that the patient requests. You're not going to get a lawsuit if someone guesses incorrectly by someone that they honestly don't know whether they identify as male or female. But you will get a lawsuit if that person insists on, you don't look like a woman to me. What kind of surgery did you have? What have you got down there? You actually hear things like that. And if it's really unclear, you can simply ask. I would give staff members who really are unfamiliar with the transgender community or who are in any way concerned by this or think that this is awkward, there are some simple phrases you can give them. One is simply, how do you identify? What pronouns do you prefer? Above all, the staff should never demean or question a patient's gender identity or expression. This just goes to anti-harassment. It doesn't matter what the staff person perceives. You treat the person respectfully based on what they request. And this comes up all the time, that staff who are not actually involved in treating the patient or are treating the patient, but the issue of their gender identity has no bearing on their treatment, consistently ask questions about, I think one that we hear a lot is, have you had the surgery? You know, as non-transgender folks, I think, come to terms with what it means to have a sex change, people have this sense of you are a woman until you have some sort of top or bottom surgery, and now suddenly we all treat you as a man. And obviously there's a range of identities, a range of experiences, and asking really detailed, invasive questions about someone's genitalia is insulting no matter who you are. But it happens all the time to transgender individuals, and it's usually defended as someone is just seeking more information. The real question is, if you need information in order to treat the patient, get that information. You should not have intake people trying to determine whether or not to call you a man or a woman by asking about whether you have a penis. You'd be surprised this happens. If there really is a need, make sure that this question is asked in a confidential manner. It's obviously private healthcare information. And the patient should be informed that this information will be kept confidential.
Yeah, and you can see how a number of these best practices sort of dovetail together. So if at the admitting and intake stage, you know, the kinds of supplemental questions about a pronoun, gender identity, identification, preferred name, are that information is taken in at intake, then there's obviously a certain stream of employees at a health institution that will receive that information. You know, people, if the chart reflects it, you know, there's that information will follow a patient, and certain people, like a treating physician, will see it. Certain, you know, nursing staff may see it. And then, of course, there are other people, I think, really addressing the interaction protocol best practice, who may not have access. Someone who just enters the room to clean it, to deliver food, things like this, who don't need to look at the chart. And so separate and apart from the information that an institution may obtain and provide at admitting or intake, there are other employees who separately will need to be trained on these kinds of protocols as to how to interact with patients. And I can't stress this enough, that this training really needs to happen, because as you can remember from some of the cases that Sandra described, a lot of them do involve harassment. A lot of them involve the repeated demeaning and verbal, sometimes physical harassment. But a lot of it involves deliberate misuse of pronouns with a transgender person that can rise to a level of actionable harassment. And that's why we stress that beyond getting that information and letting it stream to the providers who are going to be treating a transgender patient, that other staff who may be, I don't know if the right word is incidental, who may be coming in and out and interacting with those transgender patients, also be trained on that type of protocol. So the next best practice that we wanted to discuss is one that often I think kind of cuts to the heart of what a lot of people, a lot of kind of the cognitive dissonance around trans folks, and this has to do with shared space, room assignments, things of this sort. So where room assignments are gender-based, transgender patients will be assigned to rooms based on their self-identified gender. This is irrespective of accordance with the patient's physical appearance, surgical history, genitalia, legal sex, sex assigned at birth, their name, etc. So private rooms should be made available when requested and when possible. But this is part of the, I think what's tricky about this is that I think a lot of institutions, in an effort to assist or even protect a transgender patient, may try to provide that patient a private room. Because it seems like the least complicated option. But if that transgender patient says, no, I just want to be, if a trans woman says, I just want to be in a woman's room, but I don't want a private room, you can see how the same effort to possibly simplify or protect a patient could be seen as the trans patient as isolating them, as deliberately isolating them, which itself could be a form of actionable discrimination. So the idea here is essentially to treat trans people in accordance with the gender identity they present to your institution, and that includes in the assignment of rooms. Now, if requested, as we say here, a private room is requested, that's fine, but simply streamlining trans patients into private rooms is not a long-term solution to the room assignment question. Now, here's something else that comes up frequently: complaints from a patient's roommate regarding that patient's gender identity. That does not constitute grounds for an exception to the policy. And this goes way back in anti-discrimination law. You see this in essentially every context we work in, that someone else's discomfort is not a valid defense for discrimination. And that includes in this health context as well. So here are some solutions that we have, you know, heard about, generated, had dialogue with in other contexts and about health institutions, trying to address this with additions of curtains or dividers for additional privacy, or the removal of a complaining roommate if that's medically safe and appropriate. So obviously, delivery of the required health care is the bottom line. But if medically safe and appropriate, if a transgender patient's roommate continues to complain, their removal and not the trans patient would be, I think, the more compliant or safer option for your institution. And this, of course, accords with everything we've been saying all day. Harassment of transgender patients by their roommates or other patients must not be permitted. And this, again, is where some of the case examples we covered earlier come in handy, because your institution is responsible not just for the behavior of its own employees, but if you essentially if there's indifference or inaction in the face of harassment by other patients, your institution could be on the hook for that.
So I get the bathroom question. You know, there's a lot of anxiety about this. I can tell you there shouldn't be. We're going to discuss all this further. We'll leave some time at the end for questions. And I do want to discuss this issue. You know, I think at the end of the day, to us, it's fairly straightforward. Patients should be allowed to access gender-specific restrooms based on their self-identified gender. There's a lot of fear around this, that somehow transgender patients are going to go in assaulting people. Assault is still against the law. This does not permit any kind of misbehavior in the bathroom. Frankly, in the women's room, I don't see anyone else's body when they use the bathroom. There are stalls. As you can tell, we're happy to talk about this. We're a little saddened by all the hateful speech around it. But patients must not be required to show identity documents. You can't say you are permitted to use that bathroom if you show me a driver's license that says you are female. There's no guard outside the bathroom that says, please confirm that you are straight, you're not attracted to women before using this bathroom. There should be no policing of bathrooms. At the end of the day, this is a tough thing for people to deal with. And again, because there really is an issue here. We have gender segregated facilities, and you have someone whose gender has changed. Where do you let them go? But the easy answer is you let them go where it is natural for them to go as the person they are today. And staff shouldn't harass someone about their restroom use if they're going in to pee in peace. And not if other patients have problems, I think you go back to the sort of age-old rule that someone else's veto does not permit discrimination. If someone else complains, I was horrified because I saw a 6'2" person in a dress with large hands I suspect was born a man at birth, and that scares me, I don't want to use the restroom. Well, that patient can use a different bath. That patient can use a single-use bathroom. It would be the same if for race. It would be the same for, someone wearing a hijab. It would be the same, someone else's fears or anxieties are not... I think all I'm trying to say is that we'd like people, hopefully, to start thinking about not the transgender person who just wants to be in peace to be the problem, but the complainant. If someone is complaining, then and they don't feel comfortable, they can be accommodated elsewhere, but it's not a justification for putting some kind of arbitrary restrictions on the transgender patient. But we can discuss.
So, part of, to the extent that we have value here today for you, I think part of it lies in us sharing how we would go about analyzing questions if we got a question or a complaint from someone about a health institution. And so on the question about bathrooms, which is a similar one to room assignments, anywhere you have a sex-segregated facility of some kind, we'd want to know, what kinds of barriers or limitations were allegedly placed on a trans person. So for instance, the ID question is a common one, show me something that proves you are the gender you're presenting as or that you say you are. And I think sometimes in this debate, what gets lost is that not only do those requirements to change your gender markers, your driver's license, your passport, many of them vary state by state. And in many states, it's very hard to do. And in many states, it requires multiple visits to different types of bureaucracies to get a single gender marker changed. So when people try to defend the practice of saying, well, they didn't provide a document saying that that trans woman was a woman or that trans man was a man, there's sometimes a lack of appreciation of how hard that is to do. I mean, how hard it is to be a trans person, making that transition in your life is one thing, and then to go about getting the paperwork on it is entirely another, which is a very difficult kind of burden to meet for a lot of folks. Other barriers I'd be curious about, though, would be, do you want to talk about the gender markers?
Oh, just, well, this is, again, sort of my, emotional, this issue about restrooms a lot of times is pitched as, if you don't require that gender marker, then you're going to have men in women's bathrooms, all these men sneaking in. I think that there have been, as far as I know, zero documented instances of men claiming to be transgender in order to get into a bathroom. And frankly, the only people that I have ever heard of threatening to do that were people who are very opposed to anti-discrimination law. Again, anything that is normally unlawful continues to be unlawful, regardless of allowing transgender people to use bathrooms.
Yeah, but I think that the kind of the vigilantism that's actually been reported in the news around this issue of people threatening to storm into the opposite sex bathroom, are people opposed to allowing trans folks to use the bathroom? I think it speaks to the level of anxiety around this issue. But as a lawyer, you know, I think the things that I'd be looking for, these kinds of barriers, you know, gender marker proof is one of them. But even things as simple as, I'm imagining a phone call I would have with a complainant, even something as simple as someone being told, hang on, let me check with somebody else. Hang on, I got to check with somebody else. Like even delay in admission to a facility, if it was by a health institution's employee itself, could be an actionable barrier. So that's why, again, this issue of training around these protocols is critical. Because these things that can be easily addressed, of course, there's always the rogue employee situation that Sandra mentioned, and that we can't control for. But to the extent your institution does have control over these issues, it lies in training your employees. So the last policy we're going to discuss today is on privacy compliance. And this, again, is somewhere where health folks way outpace us in understanding because the laws here are complex. So overarching question, what issues arise in application of the privacy rule to transgender patients? Under federal regulations, covered entities have to develop written privacy policies to ensure compliance with the rule. And depending on the content of the information, a patient's transgender status, including, for instance, a history of transition-related procedures or treatment, surgical procedures, hormone therapy, may constitute protected health information. So some of the recommendations in this rapidly evolving area. Reviewing your institution's HIPAA privacy procedure manual, considering these issues in mind, and include discussion of whether and when information on transgender status amounts to PHI. Also include express reference to information regarding a patient's transgender status in the manual's discussion of the minimum necessary standard. And again, staff training on scenarios in which information regarding a transgender status of a patient amounts to protected health information. Also, further specifying that inappropriate use, disclosure, or request of a patient's PHI is a violation of both institutional policy and of the privacy rule. And this, I think, really arises from some of the cases we've talked about before, where a transgender patient comes into a health institution for one reason and suddenly discovers that everybody's talking about him or her. Everybody's asking questions, you know, the kinds of things like, did you have the surgery? This kind of stuff that, you know, that when it pertains to, you know, certain kinds of medical procedures is confidential information. And some real hot water institutions can get into when people start talking about this stuff without the appropriate framework in mind as to what kinds of discussions do amount to PHI about a trans patient. Also stating that such violations of the inappropriate use or disclosure request of a PHI is subject to disciplinary action for an employee. So here's our contact information, and we'll leave that up there, but now, so we have time for, okay, great. So we're happy to talk about any questions you have about any of these best practices.
Please just wait until Joyce gets to you with the microphone.
So when you've got patients or community members that are coming into your public hospital, I absolutely understand the idea that everybody deserves to be treated with respect and dignity and that certain questions shouldn't be asked. But if you know, we see a very wide variety in our hospital of patients. We have an acute psychiatric facility at our hospital. What happens in a situation where you're trying to, you know, we also have an obligation to protect patients, to protect staff, and you have somebody who is clearly, you know, to the public, portrays themselves as, you know, a man, but wants to utilize the women's locker room. So they say to us, well, you know, I'm a transgender man. I mean, we would know that they're not, but I guess from your perspective, how do we as an institution deal with that type of a situation?
Has that ever happened?
We actually have had a situation where somebody is back and forth, kind of. So it's just kind of, you know, it's an awkward type of a situation to be in because we don't want to discriminate. But by the same token, we have a number of staff members that do get concerned about, you know, that type of issue.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think what you're describing in there, I'm hearing kind of two different scenarios. You know, one is the I'll start with the less complicated one first, where your institution has sort of a question about the good faith basis or belief of how someone's identifying. You know, like a someone coming in presenting as a man who says, I'm a transgender woman, with no kind of indication in appearance, behavior, anything else about self-image that would indicate that, that might lead you to question, why is this person stating this identification here? And I think that's not as close a case. I mean, I think that using some of the best practices here, you'd say, you know, well, we're asking you to tell us more. Tell us more about, you know, your transgender female status. And I think that's not as close a case. I think the closer, harder case is the one I think you were describing towards the end, which is the question of someone whose identification may be sort of polyvalent, to use a word, you know, maybe female to male to female. And that is a more difficult question, because I think that the transgender status itself is a protected status that has a certain fluidity to it under the law. And so I think some of the questions would be, you know, for what length of time is this patient in your institution's care, for one? Here are things that I would want to know about. Or a staff member? Got it. Okay. Mm-hmm. It's interesting. I mean, the things that I want to know are about an employee, for instance, would be, what steps did the institution take to try to accommodate the employee's gender identity, you know? And so is it, you know, things I want to know, if I got a complaint from an employee saying I was gender fluid and my employer didn't accommodate me, I'd want to know a couple of things. I want to know, you know, for how long did you work there? How much did your gender identity evolve over that time? Did it change once? Did it evolve twice? Did it evolve back? And then I'd also want to know, you know, how did the institution seek to accommodate you at each of those junctures when you made this gender fluidity known to your employer? Those are the kinds of questions that I would be asking.
Yeah, and I'll repeat it. So this is an employee and asking, and the, you know, employer wants to do the right thing and is asking a lot of questions, but is it inappropriate? In that instance, I can honestly say there are no lawsuits that fit that fact pattern. And as a, you know, an attorney who used to represent employees, asking questions in that kind of context where you really genuinely don't know how the employee is defining his or herself is the right thing to do. Mostly, as you all know, treatment for gender dysphoria, you know, to the extent someone is going to transition, typically involves a date by which they start presenting as the other gender. And so when I've worked with employees who were dealing with a transition at work, what they typically did is met with the employer to talk about a plan. You know, at X date, I'd like to be called Sharon. I intend to present as a woman. I want people to know that that's how they should address me. I've never experienced that complaint where I sort of have changed back and forth. And I think you're well within your rights to ask what are your plans here? What's going on? And what can we do to work with you? Frankly, if someone really, I'm not a judge, so I don't know all the facts of this case, so I couldn't say what's lawful and what's not exactly here. But I would think that if someone really is in flux, asking them whether they're comfortable using a unisex bathroom is a decent question. If they insist they're not, you know, trying to work with them from there. But that would never be an inappropriate question where there really is a lot of confusion.
I could just add one more thing to that, because it's, you know, another thing that I would like to know in the context of this employee, and I like to frame it that way and not, you know, we always have to be careful to say we're not giving legal advice here because we don't represent anybody in this room, but things that we would like to know about are, you know, how are those questions asked by HR? Obviously, sitting down with an HR rep is a really appropriate kind of sensitive, confidential way to address the issue. But to the extent that there are certain bright line things that I think I could say or that I would want to know if they were said, would be, you know, were questions asked about genitalia, about surgical procedures, about medical procedures, because those are questions that I do not think would be necessary for HR to know. And so that's kind of an area I think that, like, I want to, if HR strayed there, that would seem odd to me. Those are questions that I don't think would really be pertinent to how does my institution assist this employee.
Just one observation, one question. I think you did a tremendous job in a non-prosecutorial way. I mean, this is an area which is absolutely loaded with all our own insecurities, our own lack of knowledge, our own paradigms, our own prejudices. And you've explained it on a very practical basis, interwoving the, you know, the case law, the legislation, and the regulations. And, you know, it's a job we don't always see out of the AG's office, let me put it that way. So I think it's very, very important. But I just had one question, which has been bugging me right since the introduction, and I'm sure it bothers all of us, who are even the lawyers and the non-lawyers here who are, you know, geographically located up here. And this is to Attorney Pullman. Why would you ever leave a clerkship in federal court in Hawaii to come to the East Coast? You're so well trained, you have good judgment, and why one error in judgment led you to the East Coast?
If I didn't work at the AG's office and made more money to afford my Hawaii home, I would be there now. Is Eric listening?
I just want to know if insurance companies have also been dealt with respect to this. If you are an obstetrician and a transgender male comes in and says he is insured as a male, but wants to have a baby, what do you do? And you're an obstetrician who really basically only deals with females, which is the birth identity of this person. I mean, the DNA, whatever.
So we do, around the country, a lot of folks are looking into insurance-related issues, but the question that followed, I think, was really about a denial of services or care. Could you work with that, or would you be okay turning away that patient? And I think, you know, the question for me would be, well, if a transgender male, because there have been obviously highly publicized cases of transgender men giving birth.
Yeah.
And so my question would be, if a transgender man came to an obstetrician's office saying, I want to get a gynecologist or obstetrician for my pregnancy, presumably that trans man can get pregnant. And so I think the question would be, you know, what I think it would boil down to as a legal matter would be, if a OBGYN turned away a trans man, you know, I think the issue would be, the defense would probably be, I didn't feel I had the expertise to work with this particular patient. And that has not been held to be a viable defense before. I mean, I think the approach... Was the question insurance coverage or...?
Well, it was both.
Okay.
It was both.
So turning to the piece first about care itself or denial of care, I am familiar with cases where, you know, saying I didn't believe I had the expertise to work with this trans patient has been held to be a not sufficient defense for turning away a prospective patient. Because I think the idea is, well, then you should educate yourself. Or if this patient says, well, I can provide you resources to help you know how particular therapies I'm on right now might affect a pregnancy, then it would be on the doctor to do that. But the insurance piece... Is a different piece.
Call us, actually. It's a real problem. We've had trans men saying, you need a hysterectomy. And, you know, are battling with their insurer who says, your gender marker is male. You know, if you have ovaries and you need a hysterectomy, you need a hysterectomy, regardless of what your paperwork says. And so an insurer who doesn't cover that is in violation of the law, and we are looking into those issues. We're getting the hook.
Doctor, can you wait 1 second?
It is almost the same question with regard to insurance. When we're looking on a dentist walking to the room, I'm looking, this is a male or female. On my chart, it's a male. Mm. And if I really didn't read all notes, I will not know about modifier, why we cannot change simple on a sex check mark, male, female, transgender, female to male or male to female, but we don't see it, the same as with insurance. Mm. And if I'm looking on insurance card in primary care, it will be the same one. I recently have a patient which we treated with dignity, she loved our facility, but again, we were verbally telling, be aware, this is not Carlos, this is a Vicky. Mm. I think all coming with a simple, EMR or simple insurance card, where really clearly we'll be stand who is the patient. Do we have some changes in a sex check mark? in the future?
I think that's a question for institutions and for the EMR, the software producers. I mean, I know.
But I didn't see, not only in my institution, I didn't see in any place that we have it.
Yeah.
You right now spoke about the meeting process, and you're telling it has to be modified. But you have to understand, all modifiers, they're going somewhere behind scene.
Yeah.
If you're looking on a band, on a hand of patient, it will be only small area, sex, male, female, nothing else.
Yeah.
And again, when we see patient in a gown, sometimes it's very confusing to understand that it's transgender in front of me.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I think, that's why we say the more intake information that's there, I understand you might not be looking at it, probably recommend that you look at that intake information. But also, at the end of the day, when we get these complaints, the real analysis is whether the treatment was respectful. Everyone can make mistakes. I mean, you can come in and refer to someone as Robert and be corrected, it's Roberta. I guarantee you it's not the first time that person has had to make that correction if it's not immediately, immediately obvious. But doing that work at the intake and trying to fold that information into what the treating physician sees is a way to avoid those awkward moments and hopefully provide respectful care. You're shaking your head, but maybe you'll reconsider. We unfortunately, I think, are getting the hook, but can leave a number of cards. Our information is there. We have a number of business cards we can leave with Linda or whoever else. And really look forward to hearing from you. We love to be able to be problem solvers and not just clean up crew when everyone's outraged and wants to sue each other for a lot of money. So thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Bomba, did you have a comment that you want to make quickly?
I just wanted to comment and ask a question on our MOLS form, which is a DOH form, sex is male or female. The issue has been raised by clinicians and early adopters very sensitively, and so we've integrated into eMOLS male, female, unspecified. That was the term that actually came out of working with real cases. So I wondered what your comment would be about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was one of the in the slide that we had up there.
Right.
On the, I think one was
other.
Other, yeah. So
which
I think
that would be okay.
Similar to unspecified, yeah.
So, do we have to get the DOH form to change?
Good question. That's actually one. That's actually one that we can take back with us. Because we're familiar with the DOH.
Thank you.